From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the controversy over university language codes. These codes are intended to protect students from racial epithets and religious obscenities directed at them by fellow students. But critics say these language codes violate fundamental First Amendment rights to free speech. We'll hear from both sides. Also, rock songs about marriage and children. We talk with British rock singer, songwriter, and guitarist Graham Parker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Persian Gulf War is officially over. The United Nations Security Council formally ended the conflict today, paving the way for a UN peacekeeping force to replace U.S. troops in the war zone. An informal truce has been in place since President Bush ordered an end to hostilities late in February, but a ceasefire could not be declared until Iraq had accepted the resolution calling for Baghdad to scrap its weapons of mass destruction. President Bush said today that the U.S. is in lockstep with the European community on the issue of aid to Kurdish refugees. The president met with EC leaders and said afterwards there was no difference in the allies' positions. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The president has shied away from the idea of a formal enclave for the Kurds in northern Iraq, fearing it might split the country. The EC endorsed the enclave idea proposed earlier this week by British Prime Minister John Major. The White House says it's merely a matter of semantics, and Mr. Bush insisted today he was in complete agreement with the European allies.
We're going to help these refugees, and please don't try to make a difference where there isn't any.
Sir, what
if you don't believe me, do what I did yesterday. Talk to John Major, and you will see there are no difference.
The president once again warned Saddam Hussein not to interfere with relief efforts and said he would not involve any American troops in a civil war in Iraq. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
The Senate Judiciary Committee has rejected the nomination of Miami Judge Kenneth Reiskamp to a seat on the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Reiskamp is the first of President Bush's 77 judicial nominees to be rejected by the Senate and only the fourth in the last decade. The panel voted 8-6 against the nomination and refused by a 7-7 vote to send the nomination on to the full Senate. Reiskamp's nomination has now effectively been killed. A senior South African cabinet minister today gave a conciliatory response to a threat by the African National Congress to halt constitutional talks with the government. NPR's John Madison reports.
Constitutional Development Minister Gerrit Viljoen briefed the media today to explain the government's attitude to the ultimatum delivered by the ANC last week. He criticized the ANC for what he called a somersault in its position. He said the threat to stop the talks was a drastic step, which the government had not expected at a time when other talks were going ahead normally. He said the ultimatum had strained the special chemistry between President F.W. de Klerk and ANC leader Nelson Mandela, but he thought that that chemistry was strong enough to survive this latest tension. He said negotiations are the only way to find lasting solutions, and we don't plan to jeopardize that. I'm John Matheson in Johannesburg.
On Wall Street today, stocks closed higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 31 points to close at 2905.45. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-1 in heavy trading. This is NPR. Italian authorities have given up hope of finding survivors from last night's collision between a passenger ferry and a tanker. A crew member is the sole survivor. NPR's Silvio Poggioli reports from Rome.
More than 140 people, passengers and crew of the ferry Moby Prince, are believed dead. The collision took place in thick fog 3 miles off the coast when the ferry, which was heading for the island of Sardinia, collided with a tanker that was at anchor. The tanker was carrying 2,700 tons of crude oil. All crew members are safe. A fire broke out and the flames enveloped the ferry, trapping the passengers on board. The one survivor from the ferry, the boatswain, said many passengers had tried to escape, but the flames were everywhere. A few hours later, off the port of Genoa, another tanker exploded, killing 3 crew members and seriously injuring all the others. Local officials say the oil leaking out of the 2 tankers could cause an ecological disaster in the Mediterranean. This is Silvia Poggioli in Rome.
The Italian premier-elect Giulio Andreotti has ended a two-week political crisis by putting together a coalition which will become the country's 50th post-war government. The Christian Democratic leader plans to present his list of cabinet members to the Italian president tomorrow. The new cabinet includes the same five political parties that have governed Italy together for much of the last 10 years. The political crisis started on March 29th when the socialists pulled their support from the government and Andreotti resigned as prime minister. But he managed to revive the same previous coalition to put together another government. Andreotti has headed six Italian governments so far. Authorities in Beverly Hills, California, say actress Natalie Schaefer, who portrayed a millionaire's batty wife on TV's Gilligan's Island, has died of cancer. She was 90. Miss Schaefer portrayed Lovey, the wife of Thurston Howell III, while the series ran on television 3 years during the 60s. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Colleges have become more multicultural. Along with this new diversity has come a rise in open expressions of racism. Many colleges are trying to combat hatred with language codes, codes that prohibit students from intimidating or harassing other students with epithets and obscenities directed at race, sexual preference, religion, or ethnic group. But these language codes are very controversial. Some civil liberties groups say the codes violate a student's right to freedom of speech. On today's Fresh Air, we'll be hearing from people on both sides of the issue. The University of Wisconsin instituted a language code in 1989. It's currently being challenged by the Wisconsin ACLU. Pat Hodelick is the senior legal counsel for the University of Wisconsin. I asked her why the university decided it needed a language code.
First of all, we had had a number of incidents of racist conduct going on our campuses, and these were fairly highly publicized locally, and they were occurring at the same time that our Board of Regents and universities were embarking on some major programs to improve recruitment and retention of minorities. So it was felt that having some sort of discriminatory harassment rule in place would help improve the environment on campus for minorities and thus help with these other efforts at recruiting and retaining minorities.
What type of language does the code restrict?
Well, it restricts actually more than language. You need to establish a number of things to have prohibited conduct under our rule. You need to have, first of all, the utterance of a discriminatory epithet, and then it has to be directed at an individual, and it has to intentionally demean that person on the basis of race or sex or another protected characteristic. And it also has to intentionally create a hostile environment for education or university work.
So you can't just defame a whole ethnic group. You'd have to call. You'd have to use an epithet against one person in particular.
That's right.
Let me read an excerpt of the university's administrative code. A student would be in violation of the language code if he or she intentionally made demeaning remarks to an individual based on that person's ethnicity, such as name-calling, racial slurs, or, quote, jokes. Ethnic jokes would be punishable?
Well, they would be if they met the other requirements of the rule in that they were directed at somebody with an intention to make that person suffer a hostile environment and be demeaned. In actual practice, with the rule in place for about a year and a half now, we haven't had a case where a joke was involved.
Does that, though, run the risk of prohibiting any politically incorrect humor on campus?
I don't think so, primarily because it's not just a matter of telling a joke to a group of people. It has to be a joke told to a protected group member with the intent to demean that person on the basis of his or her group status and so on.
How many times have you actually had to use the language code?
We have had, I believe, 32 complaints filed of violations of the provision you're referring to. And discipline has only been imposed, I believe, in 10 of those.
Can you give us a sense of the instances in which discipline was imposed?
Well, In perhaps the most serious case, a student was suspended in connection with an incident where he attempted to show false identification to enter a residence hall, and the student working at the desk and the hall director were both members of minority groups, and when they questioned him about the identification, he responded by calling them various racist names, and eventually an altercation erupted in which he assaulted one of the employees. So he was suspended for a violation of the regulation concerning discriminatory harassment, as well as for his assaultive conduct and presenting false ID. In virtually every instance, there's been some use of epithets, and in most of the instances, the disciplinary action has occurred not only as a result of the use of epithets, but because there's been some other sort of assaultive conduct or other misconduct involved as well.
I'm wondering if the majority of circumstances where the language code has come into play, where if there's also been assault involved with that, why do you feel like you need the language code? Because an assault is kind of much more clear-cut, you know what I mean, than language, which is always subjective and which is usually protected by the First Amendment.
Well, when we were developing the code, we were relying on a number of reports of situations where the conduct was purely verbal and didn't involve assaults. Now, since we've had the code in place, it has become apparent that many of these situations do involve assaultive behavior in fact. But I think that we still need something to deal with those instances where the conduct is verbal conduct that is harmful.
Pat Hodulik is senior legal counsel for the University of Wisconsin. Nat Hentoff is a longtime advocate of First Amendment rights. He has a weekly column in the Village Voice on First Amendment issues. He recently wrote a series on the debate over university language codes. He told me he objects to restricting language on campus because he opposes restricting language anywhere.
If there is a basic, fundamental engine that makes this peculiar experiment, constitutional democracy, I'm quoting Jefferson, work, it's that we all have a right to free speech, no matter how offensive. And that very much includes at a college campus.
But what about minorities or women on college campuses who are being harassed because of things that are being said to them?
You know, I've been to at least a dozen college campuses in the last 6 or 7 months. With very few exceptions, the strongest, most direct, most forthright groups are the black groups, the African-American groups, and the women's groups. To talk about protecting them is to patronize them, to indicate, well, you are so fragile, so weak, that you can't deal with this speech by more and better speech of your own.
What's an example of a code and one of its uses that you're most disturbed by?
Well, at the core of practically every one of these speech codes, there is the phrase, and if you create an intimidating, hostile learning environment, then you will be punished. No further explanation, just as there is no further explanation on most of these, any of these codes, for the phrase, if you intend to stigmatize, if you intend to insult. I mean, you think about it. Let's take two Jewish students on a campus. One is an admirer of the Likud party in Israel, Sharon, Shamir. The other one is an admirer of Shulamit Aloni, the Citizens' Right Party, and thinks there should be an independent Palestinian state. They get into a discussion. And at one point, one of the Jewish students says, you are a self-hating Jew. And the other says, you are a fascist. Should that debate be punished? I mean, the whole thing is totally contrary to free inquiry, to being able... You know, Malcolm X used to be very, very concerned that black youngsters learned to demystify speech, that they could use language so well that they would drive these bigots away just by what they said. To say that they should be cocooned because some terrible speech comes along is to do them a great disservice.
Some people have been calling the college campus speech codes politically correct codes. What do you think?
The term politically correct, I must say, though I have used it perhaps too often myself, tends, like all of these categories, to be too inclusive and therefore not very useful. I would say in terms of speech codes, while I think a lot of those students who have created the new orthodoxy, which is the left orthodoxy version of what I grew up under in college, where you had to watch out that people didn't call you a simp or communist themselves. In other words, it's now gone from right to left as to who decides what the correct thinking and speech is. Nonetheless, having said that, I think these codes are dangerous enough, dangerous in the long term, because people in college get a mindset that often goes through the rest of their lives, and they're going to learn through these speech codes that it's okay if your motivation is all right to censor people, which I think is a very dangerous long-term idea. But I wouldn't necessarily call it politically correct. It's just wrong.
When did colleges start adapting speech codes?
I'd say it started about 2.5 years ago. It started because there were very real racist, sexist, anti-Semitic incidents on a number of campuses. And instead of trying to figure out what they, as educational institutions, can do, I mean, for God's sake, if you are running a college and you can't, if you don't know how to change the perspective of a bigoted student so he or she becomes unbigoted, then you're in the wrong business. I can't think of a more stupid, uneducational approach to this very real problem than hundreds of colleges and universities are taking.
What about the idea that it's appropriate for the administrators at a university to say there's a certain kind of intolerance that will not be tolerated on our university campus?
Sure, they ought to say that, and they ought to do something about it. They ought to hold classes and seminars and forums and get people in the community that the college is part of onto the campus and start talking to these kids. But to think that they're going to get anywhere by censoring this kind of language is absurd. And it is not educational. I mean, what do you learn from being expelled? I guess you learn not to do it again, but you can't do it again anyway because you've been expelled.
Nat Hentoff writes a weekly column on First Amendment issues for The Village Voice. More on free speech and language codes after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Several of Nat Hentoff's recent columns were devoted to the case of Brown University. Brown doesn't have a language code, but it does have a code of conduct which prohibits abusive, threatening, or demeaning actions based on race, religion, gender, handicap, ethnicity, national origin, or sexual orientation. One student was recently expelled for his disruptive, drunken behavior, harassing students with anti-Black, anti-Semitic, and anti-homosexual obscenities. Critics of the decision, like Hentoff, say the student was really punished for unsavory language, not for his actions. The director of the Rhode Island ACLU has urged Brown University to change its code of conduct to clarify the distinction between behavior and speech. Vartan Gregorian is the president of Brown University. He upheld the expulsion on appeal. Gregorian says he opposes language codes, but when one student uses racial epithets to harass another student, it crosses the line into behavior the university will not tolerate.
I've defended the rights of Orthodox Jews, Orthodox Catholics, and others to attack homosexuality or attack others. You can counter those because they're discussing issues. But if somebody is coming to harass you, targets you, follows you, phones you, puts notes under your door threatening you, then it's no longer speech, no longer communication. It's harassment.
Let me ask you, you've been at universities for a long time. I know you were at the University of Pennsylvania before Brown. How long were you at the University of Pennsylvania?
10 years almost.
Have you seen the climate change a lot on campus? Do you feel like you're seeing an upswing in that kind of behavior?
Well, nationally, we're a reflection of the nation. Universities are not an oasis, which students think they are. There is upswing nationally, and in times of recession especially, there's all kinds of necessity of scapegoating people. And we see that on our campuses, where people think if we did not have minorities of the United States, maybe our problems would be no problems, would be cohesive nation. And I see that kind of scapegoating now. That's one thing I see. The other thing that is happening, there's a great deal of animosity towards homosexuals. Homosexuality is not something new. It has been with us for thousands of years, but the lifestyles and the ideologies of some people now shock others. What I say to our students, we have Baptists, we have vegetarians, we have homosexuals, we have Orthodox. You don't have to agree with them. You don't have even to respect them. But you have to respect their right on campus to their ideology, to their living quarters, and so forth. You can criticize the ideology. You can criticize their lifestyle, but you cannot harass these people. That's the distinction which somehow currently is disappearing in the national scene.
Do you think that running a university has become more difficult in the past few years?
Yes.
Are there new problems that university administrators face that they didn't face before?
Absolutely. Universities have become small city-states in which presidents have become mayors of those universities, not only chief educational officers, but mayors of those universities. At the same time, I have people from 100 nations, 50 states, hundreds of different religious and other groups, from your vegetarian to the kosher food proponent, and from animal rights all the way to libertarians, and from Democrats, conservatives, and others. So it's very hard to run a university because the society has become more complex, and we're working with a corpus of laws, federal and state and others. So it's become a very complex institution, and in which education is role of president as an educator is receding, especially if society is expecting us to do everything good and everything the right way and not a single mistake, and B, consult everyone, act expeditiously, protect everybody's right, and promote general welfare at the same time without offending anyone.
Vartan Gregorian is the president of Brown University. Ed Chen is a lawyer with the ACLU of Northern California. Chen is Asian. As a free speech activist and a minority, he sympathizes with both sides in the controversy over restricting abusive language. He helped draft guidelines concerning harassment of minority group members. These guidelines are being used by the California chapters of the ACLU.
What it says is that racism and sexism and other forms of discrimination on campus must be fought in the first instance not by censorship, but by policy changes, by integrating the campus community, both in terms of faculty, student body, curriculum. Campus administrators must speak out actively against racism and racist incidents. They can't just sit by and treat those as isolated instances. And they must take affirmative, proactive efforts to deal with racism and other forms of discrimination on campus. The second part of the policy says that in doing so, they may enact codes of conduct which do sanction certain forms of speech or expression. But those codes of conduct must be narrowly drafted. They have to do essentially three things. One, the speech that is being prohibited must be speech which is specifically intended to harass an individual or specific individuals on the basis of sex, race, color, disability, religion, sexual orientation, alienage, or national origin. Second, it has to be directly addressed to the individual as opposed to something that is announced in a newspaper or distributed campus-wide. Third, it's got to be serious enough so it actually creates a hostile and intimidating environment which impedes the educational opportunity of the victim. And then finally, we require that certain due process concerns be met, that there be, for instance, illustrations in the codes of the kinds of examples which are punishable and which are not punishable, that due process hearing rights are afforded to the student who is accused, and that the punishment be proportionate to the gravity of the violation.
Can you explain to me what the difference is between somebody who says terribly racist things about blacks or Jews or women at a rally, and it's addressed to no one in particular, but to the whole gender or the whole race? The difference between that and someone who particularly says something very misogynist to me or something, you know, very racist to a black student?
Well, the main difference is that when you have a speech in a public forum, as offensive as it may be, That is the kind of speech that really is the epitome of expression protected by the First Amendment. And whether that be a racist or a sexist message, it is one that is protected. It is like the right of the Nazis to march in Skokie, in front of the Skokie Village Town Hall. When you begin to direct a racist epithet towards an individual, I think you begin to lose the First Amendment value. You're not trying to persuade society and the public of your particular political views. At some point, your sole intent really is to inflict injury, psychological, emotional injury upon a victim. And I think that deserves very little First Amendment protection.
Your guidelines also say that to be punished, a student would have to not only use, you know, racial or misogynist language directed at one person in particular, but they'd have to create a hostile, intimidating environment that would, you know, adversely affect the educational environment for the person who's the subject of these epithets. How would you measure whether it's creating a hostile, intimidating environment or not?
Well, admittedly, that is not a simple element to apply. That element was actually borrowed from federal law, which prohibits sexual and racial harassment in the workplace. The point of that, in our requiring that as an element, is that there was concern that a single epithet, for instance, in a particular context, may not be enough to actually punish or expel a student. It may be that you have to look at the circumstances. If it's repeated, for instance, that is more likely to be punishable than if it's just a one-time incident.
Why shouldn't administrators and college students just say to people who are the subjects of these racial epithets that, well, that's the price of living in a democracy. Free speech is protected. You know, no one's allowed to hurt you. But in the world, people say ugly things. And, you know, you fight speech with more speech.
Well, you know, often people say that that the response to sort of offensive speech is either to ignore it or respond with other speech. But I think the first step in this analysis has to be to understand the nature of racist harassment or sexist harassment or other types of class-based harassment. There's a difference between, for instance, being called a jerk or an asshole and being called a Chinaman or a nigger. Those words sort of reflect hundreds of years of societal defamation. And to simply stand by and say, well, you're just going to have to defend yourself, I think is a fairly insensitive response. And I think if we're concerned about increasing enrollment of minority students, I think it's something that has to be addressed.
Did you get a lot of flack from other branches of the ACLU for coming up with these guidelines?
We got a lot of flack from everywhere, including sort of internally within the ACLU as well as from externally from the press. I think any attempt to allow some limitation on speech is going to attract a lot of attention, particularly when it is an ACLU organization that is contemplating that kind of policy.
Ed Chen is staff counsel with the ACLU of Northern California. A few points of view on an ongoing debate. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For 15 years, British rocker Graham Parker has been singing and writing songs known for their biting lyrics and angry tone. But now he's also singing about kids, dogs, and butterflies. Coming up, Graham Parker tells us he settled down, but there's still plenty to be angry about. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Members of Congress have urged the president to grant more aid to the Kurdish refugees trapped at the Iraqi border, with some of them pointing a finger of blame at the White House for the plight of those refugees. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has more.
Congressional leaders today urged the administration to act quickly to help the Kurdish refugees. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell said U.S. efforts so far have been sporadic. This can't be done by airlift alone, he said. House Speaker Tom Foley said there is $100 million in existing U.S. funds that could be used for immediate relief. And in a letter to the president, Congressman David Obey, chairman of the Foreign Aid Subcommittee, said relief money is readily available. Other than direct aid, Congress hasn't come up with any creative solutions to the situation in northern Iraq, except to hollowly demand the removal of Saddam Hussein. At a meeting to hear testimony from doctors who've just returned from Iraqi Kurdistan, members were visibly shaken by reports of hunger and death at the border. California Democrat Tom Lantos said the U.S. owes the Kurds the same degree of commitment given to the people of Kuwait. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The State Department says that there is heavy fighting between rebel forces and Iraqi government troops around the northern city of Kirkuk. A spokesman also says that there continues to be scattered clashes in southern Iraq. Richard Boucher says he cannot confirm reports of Iraqi attacks on Kurdish refugees, nor can he confirm any Iraqi military activity by helicopters or fixed-wing airplanes north of the 36th parallel. Iraqi rebels say that government troops attacked refugees heading north. On Capitol Hill, on a straight party-line vote, the Senate Judiciary Committee has defeated the controversial nomination of Miami's Kenneth Reiskamp to the U.S. Court of Appeals. Democrats killed the nomination, citing their concerns that the nominee is hostile to civil rights. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Republicans defended Reiskamp by attacking his critics, the 50 or so national groups and 100 Florida groups that opposed the nomination. Here's Wyoming's Alan Simpson.
I hate to see these things come down to the impersonal hanging, because the groups need to have a hanging. And they need to get the troops all juiced up because the money's running down, and you got to get them going again and got to get the dues back up, and it's been a long haul.
The fact is, though, that while the coalition opposing Reiskamp included the usual array of liberal and civil rights groups, there were other groups, too. For example, 9 Cuban-American Republican state senators from Florida were opposed, and the Hispanic Bar Association, which has never opposed any Bush nominee before. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 31 points to close at 2,905.45 on volume of 197 million shares. This is NPR News. President Bush has strongly denied that there are differences between the United States and its allies on protecting Kurdish refugees inside Iraq. Mr. Bush said today that he sees eye to eye with members of the European community on a call by British Prime Minister John Major for the UN to use its peacekeeping forces in order to create a safe haven inside northern Iraq for the Kurds. Prime ministers of the European community endorsed that move, then later backed away from it. The president said again today that he will not let U.S. troops get involved in a civil war inside Iraq. The president of Mexico is in Chicago as part of his nationwide tour to promote a proposed North American free trade agreement. Shirley Jihad of member station WBEZ has more on the story.
A mariachi band opened the festivities here in Chicago's Mexican-American community known as Little Village. Amid tight security, hundreds of people waved Mexican flags and shouted Viva Mexico as President Salinas de Gortari began his speech.
Señor Alcalde Daley de Chicago.
He spoke exclusively in Spanish, talked of ensuring greater economic opportunity in Mexico so people would no longer have to leave their home country in search of jobs. The tailor-made appeal, part of the Mexican president's efforts to win support for the North American Free Trade Agreement. For National Public Radio in Chicago, I'm Shirley Jihad.
In Washington, the Pentagon has lifted a 14-month-long freeze on $6.7 billion in construction projects at U.S. military bases around the world. New controls have been installed on projects in order to comply with future budget cuts and base closings. Tomorrow, Defense Secretary Cheney will propose closing or cutting back on dozens of military bases in order to save more money. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. British rocker Graham Parker may be best known for his bitter relations with his record companies. He's been on five different labels during his career, and some of them inspired biting songs, such as Mercury Poisoning, his parting shot to his first label, Mercury Records. Graham Parker came on the British music scene in the mid-70s. Rock critic Robert Christgau wrote of the songs on Parker's first album, Howling Wind, "Their fury is unmistakable. In the time-honored English manner, bass and drums play the house-rocking rhythms of Chicago and Detroit for righteous anger rather than good-time escape." Parker's reputation as one of Britain's angry young men has been tempered in recent years. On his new album, Struck by Lightning, he sings about settling down into family life. This is his song, Brand New Book. Graham Parker, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hello, thanks for having me.
I want to quote part of the lyric from the song we've just been listening to, and I think everybody who hears the album notices this line, because the words came out, not twist and shout, because that's not what a grown man writes about. I'm wondering when you started feeling that your songs had to change to reflect how your life had changed?
I think the idea behind that first off was kind of sort of anti-MTV bands, really, who all seem to be sort of, you know, singing about youth things, and some of these people aren't quite so youthful, you know. So it was kind of about that, really. That was the idea of the line, but I guess then it sort of took on a different meaning, really, relating to me. Because you go through this period when you're, after like two or three LPs, I went through a period of thinking, you know, what do you write about now? I mean, what is it all about? I'm 28 or whatever, and you can't keep writing about the stuff that burned you up in the first place, you know? Luckily, I've just been able to formulate what's going on, what I see and what I feel, into different kind of songs, like you see on the new record on Struck by Lightning. Get songs like The Kid with the Butterfly Net and Strong Winds and
Children and Dogs.
Children and Dogs, yeah, things that could not have been 5 years ago. And I feel kind of lucky that those ideas have come to me and I've been able to put them into songs and not gone strayed from my original, hopefully, integrity, you know.
Is it hard to write about children and dogs and subjects like, you know, being a father?
Yeah, it is with any kind of credibility. Yes, it is, to make it interesting. But it's all hard, you know. This whole thing is just work. That's basically what it is.
But what's particularly hard about writing, for instance, about being a father?
Well, you can't be mushy about it or sentimental. You just have to... I just try to find the humour in it. I mean, people often think my songs are so deadly serious, and there is some serious stuff in there, but I find it funny, most of it, you know. And, of course, Children and Dogs is obviously funny. It has funny lines in, I think, like, the bedroom's got two carpets and one sticks to your clothes. I mean, I've had people say, what does that mean? Well, it's... If you have a dog, you know what it means. It's in the bedroom and there's a carpet of hair everywhere and it sticks to your clothes, you know, that's what it means. So you just have to be try and be witty about it, and also it rings a chord in people. They know what it's like to have a child and a dog. They know exactly what I'm talking about, you know.
Why don't we play some of Children and Dogs? And this is from Graham Parker's new album, Struck by Lightning.
Wanted a friend, and then she'd be good. Something to play with now and again, give lots of food. We've got a yard that's big enough, she says he's like a dream. But they've got us running round in circles like a pair of clowns.
That's Graham Parker from his new album. I want to point out that it would be a cliche and incorrect for our listeners to assume that because you're writing songs about children and dogs that it means you've lost your anger, because you haven't. I mean, and there's still angry songs on the new record.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, she wants so many things.
Exactly.
It's fairly vehement, you know. Yeah, you can write. I can write angry songs in my sleep. Really, it's easier to write those kind of songs than anything else. But you just have to put it into some kind of format where you're cutting sort of below the flesh a little bit with it. So it really is spiky, you know. But it's hard to write love songs that are good, that don't just have some moon in June things, I think.
Your album came to us with a press release written by you, I think, that kind of details everything that went wrong with previous records and previous performance tours.
Yeah.
It seemed like a strange kind of press. You know, press releases usually are in praise of everything.
I hate those things. You know, it's Graham Parker started he was born at an early age, and, you know, became slightly taller than he was, you know. And played in the great pub rock, you know, all that junk, which I really quite dislike. It's all very simplistic. I thought it was better to be a bit cutting about it and have a little dig at the producers you know, generally make it fun than being too sort of serious, you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Graham Parker, and he's got a new album out, which is called Struck by Lightning. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Singer, guitarist, and songwriter Graham Parker is my guest. Let's talk about how you got started in music. Where did you grow up, first of all?
I was born in London. I grew up in a place called Deepcut, Camberley, Surrey, which is suburban country area, about 35 miles out of London, very near a town called Aldershot, which is known as the home of the British Army. And very near where I grew up, there were barracks where soldiers would be, and also some quite nice countryside, but, you know, suburbia as well, a mix of places, really.
So did you go to a school with a lot of kids whose parents were in the army?
Yeah, exactly. Quite a lot of them were. They were always getting their boxes in from Malta or Cyprus or something. The boxes are coming. My guitar's in there, you know, and it's 6 months later the boxes arrive, you know. They'd settle into their new home and then they'd be posted to, you know, Saudi Arabia or something. So I met a lot of interesting kids who were kind of rootless, really.
Did you relate to them or did you feel different from them?
I felt different from everybody all the time. I felt totally different, you know.
What was it about yourself that made you feel so different?
I don't know. It's hard to pin down, really. It's just that feeling that you've got something, you know, that you want to relate somehow. I can't really remember. I just know I felt a bit unusual. I think being slightly smaller than everyone helps a bit. You know, most kids who are smaller. Now I'm sort of grown up, I look around, there are lots of people shorter than me, but at the time it seemed like I was the shortest person in the world, you know, and you just wish you were like everybody else, but you know you're a bit different. Also, I felt as though somehow I'd missed a year at school, and I didn't know where the year went. Everybody seemed to know these basic things that I had no idea about.
What kinds of things?
I don't know, just like adding up and subtracting and things and, you know, basic sort of history things. I just didn't understand why other people knew these things and I didn't. So I imagined for a long time that I'd lost a year somewhere. Maybe I was abducted or something by aliens or something like that.
That must be it.
But, I think this is kind of thing that sort of gives you the conviction to do things alone, and that's what I did. I learned to play and write songs alone, you know. You know, that's given me a good background to keep on doing it, I think.
Did you play in bands when you were young, or did you mostly play in your room?
I had bands. I had a band when I was 13. We were called the Deep Cut Three, and then we became the Black Rockers. And then when I was 15, various bands. I think The Way Out was one of them, sort of a R&B kind of band, you know. But we couldn't play well at all. I was a very slow learner because I do everything my own way. And I really started learning guitar when I was about 21, when there was a kind of big singer-songwriter thing going on, the James Taylors and all that kind of stuff. So then I got a bit more serious about acoustic guitar and learning to play. But, you know, I didn't... it took me a long time, and I'm still learning now. I'm still becoming a musician as I go along.
You had said before that you really hate the kind of press release that says Graham Parker, blah, 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 started the pub rock scene, blah, 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 because that was really simplistic. But, I mean, it is true you were a really important part of what's, you know, become known as pub rock. And, you know, you got started playing at the Hope and Anchor, which was one of the big
pub rock places. People say that. I mean, I was a guy from the suburbs who wasn't playing regularly in bands or anything. And I met these musicians who were known as pub rock people, the Brinsley Schwartz and Martin Belmont. And we played about 11 gigs in pubs, but, you know, everyone plays it. The Police were playing in pubs, you see, you know. Mm-hmm. Nobody says great pub rock band, The Police, you know. I don't really get it, you know. It's not my scene. You just start off playing in pubs because there's nowhere else to play. I mean, where else is there? It's like playing in bars. You don't call Huey Lewis a great bar player, you know? He's a pop star, you know what I mean? And he played in bars all around San Francisco. So, you know, I find that a very limiting idea, personally. A few months, we were playing concert halls and stuff, you know. So it's the association with those musicians that got me into that sort of categorization, I suppose.
Was it at all helpful to you when you started, you know, recording in the latter part of the mid-70s to know that there was a, you know, something that was considered a movement, new wave or pub rock or whatever, but there was a category of people who were new, who were doing something different, in part by returning to the roots, but there was a place that you could be different yet fit into. I'm wondering if that felt useful.
Well, I felt that I was really the only one who had any idea when I emerged with the Rumor and made my first record and started playing around. I was, to me, I was the only one who really had any idea. I was acting like I was grabbing the world by the throat, and I was very aggressive, and I was saying, this is it, man, this is what's going to happen, this is what's happening now. And I saw other people, like Elvis Costello with his band Flip City, with about six people playing in the Hope and Anchor. Six people came to see it, I think, and he was the same. There was no aggression, no attack, no look at me. I am serious, man, you know. And I was totally different from that. So I emerged and got successful quicker than these people, and then they would come to see me and see what was going on, and I think that they picked up stuff from me. And then, of course, the Sex Pistols came along, who took it to a whole different level altogether, where they actually... Johnny Rotten said to the audience, I bet you don't hate us as much as we hate you, which I wish I'd said, you know. I really do.
Why do you wish you'd said that?
That's better than, you know, making five LPs the hard way. Just coming up with a phrase like that is going to catapult you into stardom, you know. So it was a great thing to say, and very true as well, because all these people are sitting there, you know, and this scruffy bunch are playing hideously. And was like playing hard, fast, 3-minute songs, you know, and not sort of drinking beer and, you know, looking like I was enjoying myself, you know. So anyway, then that new wave thing happened and made it possible for people to be serious about it again, you know.
Graham Parker is my guest. More with Parker in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Later today on All Things Considered, one of President Bush's appointments to the judiciary has been voted down by the committee in the Senate. We will take a look at the chaotic situation in the Soviet Union, discussing events there with a group of correspondents. We have a report from one of the correspondents traveling with Secretary of State James Baker, who appears to find his diplomatic efforts futile so far. And we're going to take another look at the Kurdish refugees, what we ought to have done, what still may be possible to do. All that is later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is British singer, songwriter, and guitarist Graham Parker. He has a new album called Struck by Lightning.
Let me play something from one of your records with The Rumor. And this is a track from your album Squeezing Out Sparks. And this is the song Nobody Hurts You. Do you want to say anything about this song?
This whole album had a very sort of almost conceptual thing about the suburbs of England, I think. It was me, after going away and touring and doing what I was doing and becoming, you know, a musician and a person with a record deal and making records, me coming back and looking at the suburbs of England a bit. And Nobody Hurts You has some references to that, and Local Girls does as well.
Okay, here we go. This is Graham Parker. Graham Parker from his album Squeezing Out Sparks. And I should mention Graham Parker has a new album. It's called Struck by Lightning. Well, you're living in the States now.
Most of the time, yeah. Upstate New York, I spend most of my time there.
Is that because you're married? Did you marry an American?
Yeah, that's right. But I spent a lot of time looking around there, and I love the country and the mountains and the wildlife and stuff. I'm a bit of a country person at heart, really. And I've lived in Manhattan, spent a lot of time in Manhattan, which is great fun, but I've got a kid and didn't really want to you know, be one of these girls who work in Balducci's and don't say please and thank you, you know what I mean? So yeah, it's nice to be in the country.
So an unanswerable question, how do you like married life and being a father and all that?
Oh, it's a great thing. Being a father is a fantastic thing. You know, seeing your baby born, it's just an amazing experience. And watching them grow up and feeling this real connection. And we all go out hunting for snakes and frogs and stuff. And that's a great joy, I think, really.
Didn't you used to collect lizards and stuff when you
were
a kid?
Yeah, I was always a herpetologist. I was very into reptiles. I'm a Scorpio, you know, a bit of a reptile. And I'm very into all that stuff, and I know quite a bit about it, you know. I've been an ecologist since I was a kid. It's not something I'm jumping on the bandwagon with, you know. I bet Sting doesn't know the difference between a garter snake and a water snake. Well, I do, pal. And, yeah, I study these kind of things a bit, and it's great to turn your kid onto that stuff. It's great to turn your wife onto it. You know, my wife holds a snake now that we just caught, and she goes and catches them herself sometimes. We check them out and have a look at them. Yeah, that one looks good. Let it go again, you know. Ah, bizarre stuff, isn't it, really? I'm supposed to be somebody hanging out in bars talking to musicians, aren't I? This is what I really do, though. I go out and look under stones.
You mean the public image of the musician is it?
I guess so, yeah. You wake up in the morning and start singing the blues or something, you know.
After a few shots.
Yeah, right. I wake up and go and look for the bluebirds, see if they're going to their box, you know. Yeah, they're back again. We got them again this year, bluebirds nesting. There goes a pileated woodpecker. Watch out, you know.
Graham Parker, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Here's another song from Graham Parker's new album, Struck by Lightning. This is Wrapping Paper.
I've broken your glass, called someone a dirty name, made a nuisance of myself in front of friends. I've dug my own grave, please don't let me lie in it. Instead, let's bury everything that caused us pain. Speak to me, girl, speak to me, darling. You're not a princess, I'm not Prince Charming. Speak with your tongue, use body language and pull your skin like a wrapping paper around my heart.
Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Persian, with Roberta Shurrock and Joan Tuohy. I'm Terry Gross.
Sometimes I feel the kicker's gone, it gets mundane. So I team up with the devil and make hell. But I hang on in as long as I know I've got you. As long as I know love's a cure that
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, singer Susanna McCorkle joins us for a concert. And we meet two of the writers with TV's 30-something. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.